Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And this week, we're going to do something just a teeny bit different. Normally, we like to pick one board game and discuss it in detail. But this week, we've got sort of like a more higher concept type of episode, just a sort of loose discussion on the idea of two-player games.
Yes.
Because, as you know, in these times we live in, sometimes, you can't really get your gaming crew back together. You're probably just stuck at home with one other person, maybe. I don't know, maybe we'll do another episode on single-player games, but this is our two-player game episode for when you only got two folks that can play the board game. So, I think the way this will go is we'll talk about kind of what makes a good two-player game for the first part of the episode, and then for the second part of the episode, we'll go over some of our favorite two-player games and what we like about them.
Right.
Does that sound good?
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
So just to kick off the discussion of what makes a good two-player game, I think generally two-player games are going to be like one player versus another. I've played cooperative two-player games, but most of the notes that I have on what makes a good two-player game applies to like a competitive two-player game.
Yeah, I have a few notes about cooperative two-player games, but it's more of like examining how they differ from having multiple players.
Okay. Do you want to start with competitive or start with cooperative then?
Let's just start with cooperative first.
Okay,
so, go for it. I think cooperative two-player games are about keeping both players engaged and giving them like equal opportunities to impact the game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is how it is for any cooperative game. You want everybody to be engaged. But the problem with two-player games comes in how do you tackle, like, quarterbacking?
Mm-hmm.
Because if there's one player that is, like, micromanaging the other player, then one player is just sitting there doing nothing, and it's a single-player game.
For sure.
And so, like, one way that a lot of larger cooperative games manage this is they give each player a lot of complexity that they have to keep track of. Think, like, Spirit Island's individual spirits. But for two-player games, it's a little harder to do that because, there are, I believe, asymmetrical cooperative two-player games where, like, each player has pretty much completely different mechanics going on,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, one way to help mitigate it. Just make it so they're kind of playing two different games that work together.
Like one of those bomb defusal games.
Yeah, like that. It's both players have their own objectives and their own rules to follow, but because of that, they're equally engaged, mm-hmm. as long as they kind of interplay between each other.
I have played Spirit Island 2-player recently. And it still has relatively enough complexity that it at least it starts out with both players having pretty equal like engagement, agency and decision making. As the game goes on, though, you start to learn what the other player has much quicker than you can with like a multiplayer game of Spirit Island.
Right.
So it can get to that quarterbacking point.
Right. I feel like I've seen more two-player games have hidden information for cooperative mm-hmm. games because this is sort of just a straightforward way of preventing quarterbacking is sure. neither player knows all knowledge. And I mean, this is something that you can't really enforce as the designer other than mm-hmm. just have something in the rule book that says, hey, keep these hidden.
Yeah. If you were to apply that to Spirit Island, you might say like, keep your hands to yourselves rather right. than playing with them like face up. So everyone knows what is that all players' disposal.
Right. But I think it can make for a more interesting game that way if you limit what information can be shared between both players.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of think of things like the mind as well in this, where if you're only playing with one other person, then you kind of learn how they count a lot quicker. So by limiting information, you're able to make it a more meaningful shared experience that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think of a cooperative game, like, why would people be playing this beyond just playing a game? Or, like, what can you do with a cooperative game between two people is, you know, sort of support this, like, paying attention to the other player and how they act about certain things.
That all kind of ties into a note that I have about for competitive two-player games, in that there's can be a greater emphasis on reading your opponent.
Right.
But similarly, yeah, this is a fair point, that in a cooperative game, you can have just as much emphasis on reading your allies.
Right, yeah.
And yeah, The Mind is a great example of that. I have played The Mind 2-player. I only got to, I think, about level 7 or 8. It is still very difficult. The Mind understands that, though, and makes the threshold, the goal that you're trying to reach level-wise, higher for a lower number of players.
Right. I do want to say that you do see a mix of game durations in cooperative games for two players,
mm-hmm.
as well as competitive games for two players, of course. I think it goes either way, because, like, a two-player cooperative game can, like, just spend, you know, you can spend, like, an afternoon playing it, and it's more of, like, a shared storytelling type mm-hmm. of thing. But shorter cooperative games like The Mind are easier to just replay if you lose. Kind of arcade style.
Cooperative games definitely have more leeway for being, long game lengths. I also think that setup time is important in a two-player game, more so than a party game or a multiplayer game. But when it comes to a cooperative game, I think you have more leeway with how long the setup time goes.
Yeah, I think. You can think
it just seems like you don't want to put like so much effort into something like in a competitive sense. You don't want to put so much effort into something that you might lose really quickly. But yes, in a two player game, in a cooperative game, it feels more worth it to set it up if you're going to be spending a long time playing that game.
I especially see this in games that are like DM-less D&D campaigns. Or like role-playing games that are kind mm-hmm. of based off tabletop role-playing games, where you might not want to have one person be a DM and the other player be a player. Instead, you have both players as players working together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of using the constraints of having only two people to its advantage.
Yeah, it's much easier to have that narrative. Building that narrative when it's just two players kind of working on it together.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's about all I have for cooperative games.
Okay. I have a lot more for competitive games.
Yes.
Because competitive two-player games, I feel when you compare them to a competitive multiplayer game, there's, someone wins oftentimes and then everyone else loses, but there's at least like second, third, fourth, whatever, and most of the time a competitive multiplayer game is designed so that it doesn't appear like anyone could win until the very end of the game. At least that's the way the most successful ones appear to be designed, is like anyone could win up until the last turn. It's different for a competitive two-player game, because like obviously there's pretty much always an idea of like who's ahead and who's behind. It's not hard to compare where everyone's standings are in a two-player game, because there's just two people. There's just yourself and your opponent. So it's easy to size things up, and there is no second place really. At least it doesn't feel that way. When you play a two-player game and you lose, you just lose.
Right.
So I think a lot of the characteristics of two-player games are successful two-player games, at least, are there to mitigate, these aspects of two-player games versus multiplayer games. So one thing that I have is that there is a quick setup to the game, because you would hate to spend all this time and effort, setting out all these, pools of tokens and dice and miniatures and setting up this big, gigantic board, just to lose in the end. I think, although that correlates to the second point, that I think two-player games should be shorter than a multiplayer game would be, not just like a full player's worth of decision-making shorter, but like even shorter than that. Just because like if you play a two-player game and you lose, you would either want to have the game be short enough that you would be willing to play it again and try and win, Versus like you play, you lose, you feel bad. That's it. There's no more. You don't want to play it anymore. You don't want to go through that anymore. And you know, I think I said that setup was like correlated to game length with co-op. Like if the game lasts long, you're willing to spend longer to set up the game. That could probably be true for a competitive game.
Right. I wanted to kind of like work backwards a bit behind this. Okay. So the thing about having two players instead of three or more is when you have multiple players, like it's kind of what's the word, like manners, I guess, to not just concede. You know, you don't leave the table or whatever. Mm-hmm. But because of that, games are kind of built to, like you said, give this feeling that you can still win throughout the entire time, so that during the game you don't feel miserable.
Mm-hmm. Now, usually that's through the point, like it, like games, multiplayer games won't have like a chess element where you're slowly like dwindling resources until you have nothing.
Attrition.
Yeah, that's not common in multiplayer games. Usually you just gain more and more resources with very few ways of removing them.
Right.
And if there is a method of removing resources, it's never, you know, as, you know, heavy a cost as it took to gain those resources.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Now, because in two-player games, there's only two players, it is really one player's decision whether or not they want to concede.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, like, if you think you're going to lose, then why not just concede? Because the other player is the winner. You're not impacting anybody else.
Sure.
You know, this is sort of... I mean, this is common practice in, like, tournament play for games, partially because of time restrictions. But really, like, nobody's forcing you to continue playing, you know, a game of, like, Hive or something. And because of that, I think that kind of helps add to why so many competitive games are short and do quick setup, is because there is more of a it's more accepted to like concede and then just do another one.
Sure.
So they kind of facilitate that, so that if you want to concede because you're in a no-win situation, you can, and it's okay because you can just try again and it doesn't feel bad to try again.
Mm-hmm. I think conceding is an interesting thing to bring up. I don't think we've really talked about conceding on this podcast yet, and like kind of what it means in terms of game design or just games in general. But you can obviously tell that, like, in a multiplayer game, if somebody were to play half the game and then concede, they've made choices most likely that have seriously affected all the other players. And now that they're no longer in the game, it's just like, why were they allowed to make those choices?
Right.
That's
not to mention that there's always set up rules for, you know, three players versus four players in a lot of games.
Sure. Also, after a player is conceded, what happens to the things that they've done? Do they remain in play or do they get removed from the game to pretend as if they never existed? Like they have far reaching consequences, the actions of a player, if one player concedes, it could like, if they just hadn't been playing in the first place, the outcome could have been totally different.
Right. Most games don't have rules for this to be a situation.
Yeah. But in two-player games, like, it's just you and them, and if you think you're losing, I don't think there's any shame in conceding if you're just done with things. Let's see.
I mean, personally, I think it's okay to concede also if it, like, if...
Yeah.
Playing the game would impact your mental health.
Yes. And so because of that, it's important for a game to have quick setup, not just because, like, you know, the game was over so quickly, why'd we waste all that time setting up, but also like, okay, that game's done. You could also say like the game should have quick reset up, just to say like, okay, that game's done, but I want to play again now that I'm, you know, more familiar with the rules, or I have a different idea of what I can do this next game. So let's set it back up again and do it again.
Right.
That's at least common in lots of the two-player games that I have played and that I enjoy playing.
Right. Now, you actually brought up another point I wanted to make when you brought up just, you know, resetting, is mm-hmm. that you see a lot of competitive two-player games have like a lot of depth and complexity compared to multiplayer games that are like equally popular. But I think part of that is because you can iterate on the strategy way quicker because of the easier setup time and reset time. So, and I mean, part of that's also because of, you know, some of the most oldest games in history and most popular in history being these very deep abstract games that mm-hmm. no doubt sort of influence people that design new two-player games. But like what I'm saying is, you know, you'll see a lot of two-player games be designed with all these like specific, you know, interactions and things because you can iterate on them quicker.
Mm-hmm. I find that successful two-player games have relatively simple rules, but deep strategy in the same vein that we're, you know, speaking in right now. Right. Mostly because I find it important that a two-player game be easy to pick up quickly. Like, this is all just hinged on the fact that, like, the game is fast, the setup is fast, the playing is fast. You would hope that the rules are fast and simple to learn, again, so that you can start to, like, interpret them and think about them in unique ways.
Yeah.
And on top of that, it's like, since it's just you versus the other player, if it's a very complicated game, then it's unfair for the more experienced player in a two-player game, you know, if the rules are super complicated. If the rules right. are simple, though, you know, a new player can pick up on some things and formulate some strategies and ideas very quickly just in their first game.
Right. A lot of competitive two-player games have, like, not necessarily a beginner mode, but they do have beginner options.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, I think, well, I mean, they do have just like straightforward paths you can take.
Well, I might like, be thinking for example, of
trading like card BattleCon. Game. Oh, well, yeah.
BattleCon has like their characters ranked by difficulty, and they have like a suggested like this person versus this person should be your first fight if you play this game.
Right.
And then like, yeah, like intro decks in Magic the Gathering is another good example.
Right. Yeah.
Like they generally have very simplified strategies and cards. They're not as powerful as, you know, a tuned competitive deck. But that's not, you know, the purpose for them. They're supposed to like, you know, teach you the basics. And that said, and this goes into another point, there is some RNG in some of the two-player games that I've enjoyed, so that a new inexperienced player could potentially defeat a more experienced player.
Yeah.
But I generally find that most two-player games have a higher emphasis on player skill.
Right. I did want to say along the lines of complexity, though, real quick, or like with depth and all that, is
okay.
A big thing that I think you don't realize until you like really try to design a two-player game is like multiplayer games have a lot of downtime you can use to read things.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean is like in a multiplayer game, you can have these individually complex, like, or complicated like cards or abilities or stuff, but you get to wait three people's turns before you have to actually use it. You know, so you might draw a card at the end of your turn and it does a thing, but you can read it and you have a lot of time to really understand it. But with two-player sure. games, you don't have a lot of time because there's only one turn before you have Although, to go again.
That said, I think that two-player games, a single turn can be longer than in a multiplayer game. Since
sure, it's,
you just have to wait for one of them before the game gets passed back to you.
It's a matter of pacing, I guess. It's mm-hmm. like, with two-player games, you kind of want the pacing to be even between players. Like, oftentimes one player's turn shouldn't be hugely longer than the other player's. But at the same time, you know, time real estate is pretty important. If that makes sense.
I think the two-player games that I enjoy are the ones where the game just kind of gives you as much time as you need.
Sure.
To think about your turn. I mean, honestly, how long you think about your turn is up to you and your opponent. Like your opponent could just say like, oh, this is taking way too long. I don't want turns to take this long. Can we play a little faster? But personally, you know, I don't mind a longer turn in a two-player game. In a three-player game or a multiplayer game, somebody taking a super long time on their turn is just it impacts so many other people.
Sure.
And it eventually just becomes like the crowd versus you. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think a way to put it then would be that in multiplayer games, since there are other people taking turns and there's enough time between them, you have enough time to like think things through, so your turn should go kind of quickly. In sure. two-player games, it depends on how long the opponent's turn went as far as how much time it takes for you to like, or how much time you have before you have to take a move. I mean, most games don't have chess clocks or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is like, it feels like, I don't know, maybe there's more complexity in two-player game. I don't know. I just mean like, it's something to think about if you're designing a game, is just how much time is being allotted, quote unquote, and how hard is it to understand the thing that you're giving mm-hmm. players.
Well, there's definitely still like, even if in like a multiplayer game, if everybody's turns were like the shortest they could possibly be for that game's, you know, mechanics, there's still, you know, time to just communicate like what you do for your turn, and that you've passed your turn to the next person, and the next person realizing it's their turn and doing their thing and communicating that they've done it and passing it to the next player. So there's a lot of like, you know, padding on people's turns in that regard. In a two-player game, like if you've made up your mind on what you want to do during your opponent's turn, then you do it real quickly, then it's immediately back to them. That's just not enough time to process like a thing you've just drawn. Like right. using magic, for an example, like if you've drawn a card that you've never read before and you look at it, see what it does. I think that I want to segue from that into talk about like Res Arcana and drafting as a mechanic Ooh. In a two-player game, because I think using that you do have the option, or you do have the ability to like go over what the game does with gameplay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you kind of know what everything you have is and what it does before the game actually starts, by making the setup of the game part of the gameplay. So this is like an exception kind of to the quick setup rule that said like you might want a quick setup for a quick game. A game like Res Arcana, which I've played two player, you can draft as part of setup, or at least part of setup is like looking at your deck and making a couple last minute decisions before the game actually starts. Because of that, like the setup is a bit longer, but now it's got like gameplay elements and important like information to it. It sort of excuses it.
Right. You can also say the same for Hive, mm-hmm. that since you don't have to put any pieces on the board beforehand, the game really starts with the setup. That game, you know, there is no board, but yeah. I think that's a good point that, like, you can do these things to make the start of the game a bit more interesting that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it does give a good chance to, like, learn everything beforehand. I guess Hives doesn't actually really teach you how things work beforehand, but mm-hmm. it does immediately get players involved in the game, which is still useful.
We talked a little bit about reading your opponent.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was a big thing. Yeah. So that's the other thing about like iterative games, where you can play them in really quick sessions and then replay them. Not only do you develop strategies, but you develop habits, or you pick up on your opponent's habits. A lot of competitive games are designed with like a sort of rock, paper, scissors in mind, because sort of a consequence of this, that, if you have these like cyclical counters, then you'll pick up on your opponent's habits of how they use them even more. If that makes sense. Like mm-hmm. if your opponent throws paper most often, then you'll know that, you know, they'll probably throw paper if they haven't thrown that in a while. Yeah. So like, because you're playing it over and over again, you can learn sort of what strategies they go for, what specific counterplay they gravitate towards, mm-hmm. stuff like that.
And if you're designing a game like that, you can be a lot less, upfront or forward about like how these things interact with one another, how the strategies, you know, interact and counter each other, you know, rather than saying like, oh, obviously in the rules, like this card destroys this type of card from this strategy. You could just be a little more vague, and then the players will probably come up with it as you've intended it to, just by those iterations.
Right. A lot of competitive two-player games are built around counterplay in a way, where mm-hmm. like specific actions will hinder other actions. But yeah, you don't see these often as hard counters where it specifically says, you know, scissors beats paper, because they have a lot of time to figure out what actually beats what.
Mm-hmm. I have one last point about competitive games. It's sort of a two-parter.
I wanted to say something similar along the lines of what we said, okay. which is that there is an idea of intentionality in competitive games, where it's like the state where a player is making choices with knowledge of what they do. So like you're not just playing your creature because you have it in your hand, but you know you're playing it because you know it's safe to play the creature and it is useful in this method. This isn't as prominent as of an idea in board games as it is in video games, but nonetheless, it's another thing that like the quick playthroughs and play sessions really help inch towards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The last point that I want to make is that there is a greater emphasis on player skill in two-player games with low amounts of like randomness. There is some randomness, like I said, in some of the games that that I've written down as good two-player games, just so that there's the chances for a less skilled player to defeat a more skilled player, or at least the games turn out slightly different every time you play. With the greater emphasis on player skill, there's also an emphasis on player expression in two-player games that I think is pretty different from multiplayer games. Just thinking like if you sit down to play like a game, like a multiplayer board game, you're kind of like just playing the game, you know, the way that the game was designed. If that makes sense, like you sit down and the game gives you these pieces and you do the thing that the game tells you to do with those pieces and then somebody wins, versus like in a two player game, it feels like in lots of the two player games that I have written down, there's like some amount of like, this is how I play the game. And I guess that can come from like the simple rules and the deep strategy. But I think that's just an interesting distinction to make. Some of that comes from just like some of the two player games like Magic. It's just like, oh, you have so much expression because you can build your deck. And there's other games like Res Arcana where you don't get to build your deck with as much control, but you still have some amount of control when you build your deck. Still, it just seems like with a two-player game, there's some sort of greater amount of self-expression, just because you don't have to, like, as a designer, juggle, so many things and so much balancing. Like, you can kind of give a player more avenues to go down in their strategy.
A lot of two-player games are kind of designed around archetypes, where it's like, you know, this style of play or this style of play. And like you said, because not as many of them are interacting together at once, it's easier to balance them on like that 1v1 basis.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to worry about all of them existing in the same game. So it's a little easier to balance more archetypes.
This may also just be a result of this iterative process, because this kind of makes me think of like people that play video games, you know, so many times that they know so many tricks that when you watch them play the video game, it's like they're playing a different game altogether, or like they come up with new games to play in the game, like rather than them, their Skyrim playthrough being about, you know, going to the final boss and defeating them, you know, they do like really bizarre things with, you know, the items and the economy or the NPCs or just the systems in the game, if you know what I mean. And I think that just comes from like familiarity, which comes from repetition and time. So someone can play a two-player game like Magic for so long that they can make a deck that doesn't actually like play Magic the way that you would assume it would normally be played, with like creatures and attacking your opponent's life.
Yeah.
Okay. So with all that, let's go to our quick little break in between segments where we do our plugs, and then we'll get into a list of our favorite two-player games. So for plugs, you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. You can hit us up with your suggestions for games you'd like to hear us cover there. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, to find all our episodes cataloged, as well as a link to our TeePublic store, which can also be found at tpublic.com/user/bgbcast. And you can find a link to our Patreon on our website.
Right. Our Patreon is at patreon.com/bgbcast. For $1 minimum, you can support us that way and get a shout out. We don't have any new shout outs or anything. And I believe there's also an Ask Us a Question, where you can submit a question for us to answer during one of these breaks. Again, we don't have any new ones of those, so it's free real estate if you want to come and hit us up with some of those. And then also for $5 or more, you can get access to our bonus series, Board Game Bros Let's Make a Game, where I make a game over the course of the podcast, and Board Game Bros The Dusty Shelf, where every month I dust off an old board game that we wouldn't normally talk about and go over the history, the design, sort of what made it such a classic. And there will be a new one next week. So if you're interested in that type of thing, then, you know, go ahead and subscribe so you can be alerted when that shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/TWAK. I stream on weekdays at 1 p.m. Central Time. I stream competitive games, speedruns, roguelites, platformers, you name it. And I also have a Discord server that you can find through there where you can talk to both of us and fans of our work. And you can also follow me on Twitter at MattCraigGaming.
All right. And I stream on Twitch as well at twitch.tv/RadicalHawks. That's twitch.tv/RadicalHawkz. I stream on Wednesdays, and I don't know. I just stream anything that I'm feeling lately. So Teamfight Tactics, Animal Crossing, Dark Souls, you name it.
Nice.
All right, so now we're back into the episode, and we are going to give a list of two-player games that we enjoy and why we enjoy them.
Yes.
So I think right off the bat, we just start talking about Chess and Go, because I think Go is going to be on both of our lists.
Yeah, I actually didn't make a list, but I'm going off the cuff. But
okay, off the cuff. That's awesome. But I think Go would be on that list anyways.
Yes.
For a lot of the reasons, quick setup. Literally, there is no setup for Go. Like, you just have a blank board and two bowls of pieces. I guess if the pieces haven't been separated, you should be storing your pieces separate anyway. So
technically,
so
determining who goes first is set up.
I guess so. So you determine who goes first, and then you play Go. So setup is zero, pretty much. The emphasis is on player skill. There's no randomness to the game because, it like chess, all players have, you know, all knowledge and all control over what they do over the course of the game. The game time in either game can, it's sort of just dependent on how long players take their turns, whether one player concedes because they know that they've lost or that they're in a very difficult to win position. And if the games do go long, generally it's worth it because that means that the game has been that close for that long.
Yeah.
Except sometimes in Go, it can be a little hard to read, you know, who's winning and who's not. So at the end of the game, one player could be very far ahead compared to the other. But because of that, you don't actually know that until the very end of the game when you count. So it's still sort of the same situation where it feels like it's a close match. Right. There's plenty of player expression in either game because in chess, there's tons of opening theory. And even at just a more basic level, without doing much research, you just kind of decide for yourself, like, which pieces you want to try to attack with. You know, do you want to use like a wall of pawns? Do you want to send your bishops out or your knights out super early and do some fun things with them? Do you want to castle your king and then get your rooks in play? Do you want to just run your queen all over the map? It's up to you. In Go, you know, you can play for territory. You can play for influence. You can play a super aggressive game and just try to capture your opponent everywhere they live.
You can go for a lot of invasions.
Yeah, you can invade your opponent's territories and try to live in very difficult situations. So there's plenty player expression that comes from the depth of strategy in these games. Right. And the rules are relatively simple. Go has a pretty simple rule set. It's only a handful of rules and you know how to play. The strategy, you might have to do a little bit of research with that game. With chess, rules are similarly simple. Each piece moves a very specific kind of way. Each piece moves different from one another. And the goal is also very easy to understand.
Right. Okay. There's some of the chess errata you might have to look up if you're like me and never really played it a whole lot before. Recently.
Only just like, what are the rules of castling? What is en passant?
Yeah.
And
that's it.
Is there any more?
I think that's it.
Yeah, castling and en passant. And sure. And then the rest is just kind of up to you. I think these two games are particularly good if you enjoy like researching how to play games.
They literally have hundreds of years of study.
Yes. And I've learned recently that there are people who are averse to like having to do research for their game, or having to do like outside of playing the game, having to put in more effort to understand how to play and how to win at the game. But I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, you might already be in the population of people that enjoys researching games while you aren't playing them.
Yeah, like me.
So in a similar vein, we have Magic the Gathering that involves a lot of gameplay outside of the game, just in building your decks. However, you know, that work can be done for you if you just want to get intro packs, or I don't know. I think Magic has been putting greater effort into building more competitive and strong, you know, entry points into Magic the Gathering, so it's not so bad as it used to be.
Right. Yeah, for me, Magic isn't just the game, it's literally all the stuff outside of the game, deck building, craft. Like, I love to just come up with decks, or like to iterate on an idea for a deck. It's pretty much the ruler of player expression.
Mm-hmm. If you want that Magic style 1v1 gameplay but don't want all the metagame, then you have Keyforge, which is a similar type of game where you have creatures and spells and you attack one another, instead of building your deck, each Keyforge deck is built of procedurally generated card lists, and every deck is meant to be untinkered with, unaltered. You're supposed to play with every deck as it was bought, and every deck should have a relatively similar power level, but it's still different strategies and depths and complexities.
Right. Yeah. I think for me, I like Keyforge, but I also dislike it just because I'm a person who knows what I like to play in competitive card games.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it's hard for me to play a deck that I don't click with that much.
Sure.
But it's still a well-designed game. I obviously, you mentioned it briefly earlier, but Battlecon, love. It's an adaptation of fighting games as a concept, or as a genre.
Think like Street Fighter distilled in a board game.
Right. So you choose characters. There's a stage with an amount of distance between each player. There's a timer, and then every turn on the timer, players simultaneously play cards face down that represent their attacks, and then they reveal them, and whoever has the higher priority does their attack first. And then if it dealt enough hit stun to the opponent and they don't have enough armor through it, then they get stunned and they can't do anything for that turn. Mm-hmm. But
You cycle through your cards, so you can't play your highest priority card every turn. You have to wait a number of turns before you have the option. And not to mention that you have these cards with priority, but then each character has the cards that modify all of your moves, so they could increase or decrease priority, and they give you, you know, counterattack options or reasons for why you shouldn't be attacking first.
Right. What's really nice is, for one thing, it's completely deterministic, but there's a ton of mind games and mind reading. because there's a lot of these soft counters where, like, you can kind of figure out where those cards will be better than other cards, but you don't know what your opponent will play necessarily, so you have to kind of figure it out based on their habits, which is very fighting gamey. Also, there's a ton of characters. There's like three or four large sets of Battlecon with completely unique characters between them. I only have one of them, and I super enjoy it because
there's we haven't just, even like, played every character.
There's so many different play styles you can play as, and so many different unique mechanics.
The game has the characters divided into like five levels of difficulty. So there's just in the one set we have, there's like six or there's like, is it like six characters in the easiest difficulty?
Yeah.
So that's already, you know, that many matchups that you can go through and learn and understand. Tons of depth there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. I have Star Realms and Hero Realms if you have the deck building itch. Obviously, because they're deck builders, there's definitely some randomness to it, but there's still like plenty of expression the way that they've designed their factions in that game. And, you know, by deciding like how you combine the factions and utilize them can really change how your deck works.
Right.
I think we decided that Hero Realms is slightly more balanced between the different factions. Is that?
I think so.
In our Hero Realms episode?
Yeah.
But Star Realms is still a classic, and I still enjoy playing it.
Right. I think Dominion is my favorite two-player deck builder.
Dominion, however, has, unfortunately, a very long setup time.
Right. I definitely, like, play the online version enough that I kind of forget how long the setup time is for the physical version.
Oh, yeah. The online version, the digital version, just has just a single click and you've set up the game.
Right.
So if you're going to play Dominion, the digital version will save you a ton of time and effort.
At least if you're going to play two-player Dominion competitively. Right. It's also very active, which is nice. But I think that's where, like, the game really shines, because since both players can buy the same cards, it does end up being pretty deterministic. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you have the random shuffles of your deck, but since you can control what goes into your deck, there's a whole lot of focus put into on how many of each card are you buying, when are you buying them, will they be shuffled into your deck the next time it gets shuffled or not, stuff like that.
I'll point out that there's an app called Randominion that, it, at least if you're trying to play a physical version of Dominion, you can use this app to catalog which expansions you have and to create, you know, balanced fields of cards or fields of piles of cards that you're drafting from.
Yeah.
So I would suggest using that app just to save a little bit of setup time if you go for it. Seven Wonders Duel is a decent two-player game that we've played. The setup is a little interesting in that game because you do have to arrange different cards in like different specific ways, but generally it's a pretty quick setup.
I would also recommend Hive and Santorini, but all three of those last three games we've done episodes on. So if you are interested in more about those particular, we've done full episodes on them.
Less player expression, I'd say, but they still have different, you know, avenues. At least in Seven Wonders Duel, there's different, like, avenues and ways to go down, but less player expression compared to Hive and Santorini.
Right.
Hive and Santorini are pretty abstract as far as games go, so that means you have a lot of room to do what you want to do.
Right.
Let's see, Res Arcana and Bunny Kingdom I have as competitive, you know, big box board games. That are multiplayer in addition to being decent two-player games. Res Arcana like has that, you know, Magic the Gathering like creature spell slinging type of gameplay, but instead of it being like creatures and stuff, it's like artifacts that work together in like interesting engine building ways. And if you play with the draft mode, I think it becomes even like that much more interesting, especially as a two-player game.
Yeah.
And then Bunny Kingdom is entirely drafting. But I found that playing Bunny Kingdom two-player, you make even more decisions between like something you need versus blocking your opponent and what your opponent is trying to do. It felt like versus like compared to a multiplayer game of Bunny Kingdom, the two player game, I was more often drafting what my opponent needed.
Right.
Especially because in that version, you both pick the card that you will play or the cards that you will play, but you also discard cards to a discard pile for the rest of the game that your opponent can no longer access.
Yeah. Let's see. I like Mr. Jack is a two-player deduction game. Mm-hmm. We did an episode on it, I believe.
Oh, yeah. That was a fun game.
Yeah. I get a copy of that. That's a really good asymmetric one as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where both players have kind of similar actions, but they have completely different goals. And it's a lot of, like, trying to trick the opponent or trying to play around with information. So right. It's one that really quickly iterates on the mind game portion.
And once you have the setup memorized in that game, the setup is pretty quick.
Right.
You just kind of have to know, like, which characters go where on the board.
Yeah.
Because they don't have it really clearly marked on the board itself. As far as cooperative games go, Spirit Island, like I said, was relatively enjoyable. I imagine it would be more enjoyable. So I think when we talked about multiplayer, the complexity was a good thing because it prevents quarterbacking. In two player, at least with somebody who's less experienced with the game, the complexity causes more quarterbacking.
Yeah.
Because I'm speaking personally because this is my situation. I had to do a lot of the explaining and the strategic planning in the game because my cooperative partner was not as experienced in the game and didn't really know what exactly to do. But I think that'll make for a more enjoyable game once everyone is more acquainted with the rules and more experienced with it. Because then I think that's the best situation for like attempting more and more difficult scenarios in that game.
Right.
And then I also have the mind because the mind is fine.
I did want to bring up my favorite big box game for two players that has way too long of a setup for two players, but it's worth it, which is Food Chain Magnate. We did an episode on it a while ago. I think it plays extremely well two player, and it's not too bad to reset once you have it set up, but the initial like getting everything out of the box can take quite a bit.
Sure.
But it has this great blend of like determinism and trying to play around your opponent and predict what they do, especially to like try and compete for milestones and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of player expression with what type of build you do. I've heard the expansion also makes this better, but I haven't gotten a chance to play it yet.
Man, the expansion is so expensive.
Expensive expansion.
Yeah.
Good magic card. And then the other one I wanted to mention is Smash Up, which is it plays similarly to a competitive two-player like trading card game, but its deck building is so streamlined because you really only have two decisions to make instead of 60 or something. Mm-hmm. Which is just which two factions do you want to mix together, but it allows for a lot of the same customization because you can like try out all these different combinations of factions and all that.
You get to way more than 60 decisions when it comes to like which two factions to pair together.
Yeah.
Especially as you add expansions onto it.
Right. And that's another one we did an episode on.
Mm-hmm. One that we haven't done an episode on that I'm excited to try. I haven't actually played it yet, but I just got it in the mail today. Is a game called Sanctum.
Ooh.
Which is it's a co-op competitive. It's mostly co-op, but then there's a competitive aspect at the very end. Game that is essentially a board game distillation of Diablo. So everyone plays adventurers that go on a quest to defeat a demon lord. You fight a bunch of demons and monsters along the way and obtain gear that you equip to your character. And your character also has a skill tree that you unlock as you defeat demons and gain experience. So I'm very interested to see how that game plays. But it seems like it's going to have a very satisfying two-player game mode. Another one that we haven't played that is a similar like co-op competitive type game is Return to Dark Tower, that we are pretty excited to check out once that is done, you know, being kickstarted and being created.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
I think that's about it for me then.
I suppose with that, we'll end our episode on two-player games. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
And we will see you next week, possibly with a discussion on Sanctum. Who knows? Also, not next week. Two more weeks.
Yeah. Also, tweet at us if there's any other two-player games we should check out, or if there's any games that work surprisingly well with two players that you want to bring up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Hit us up again on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. Yep. Thank you for listening.
See ya.